right now, I mean, it is the number of your peers and young people I'm working with who, again, are able to articulate, I understand my life is very, very blessed right now, and I have so much privilege. And also, between this pandemic and between structural supremacy surfacing,
yeah,
I don't know how I am going to get through the next few days or few weeks.
I'm Lily Cornell Silver, and welcome to the first episode of my mental health focused interview series, Mind Wide Open. My intention for this series is to destigmatize mental health and to normalize having open discussion about mental health. My first guest is author of titles such as Trauma Stewardship, The Age of Overwhelm, and she's the founder and director of the Trauma Stewardship Institute, Laura Lipsky. In addition to being my best friend's mom, Laura has been such a guiding light in my life, and she is such an outstanding example of compassion, integrity, openness, honesty, and I am just so grateful to be able to have her here to share her invaluable insight with you guys. So thank you so much for tuning in and enjoy the interview.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Lily.
How are you?
I'm great.
This is the first episode of Mind Wide Open.
Woo!
So exciting. Thank you for being here. I've been bugging you about it for months at this point.
But you
are the perfect first guest for this. And I mean, it was completely intentional having you here. I think you're the perfect person to set that tone of openness and authenticity and compassion that I want to bring to this series. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to get to do this with you.
As you know, I launched a series in honor of my dad, who openly struggled with mental health throughout his life. But it also felt especially important to launch it now in the wake of the pandemic and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, that mental health is something that more and more people are openly struggling with or realizing that they have an issue with and are seeking resources and don't know where to start. So this just feels super important. And I'm so glad that you can be here to start it with me. So you are trauma expert extraordinaire. In my mind, you know everything about everything always.
You're generous. You're very generous.
There's so much stigma surrounding mental health, and that's something that obviously you're very aware of, mm-hmm. stigma surrounding trauma. And mm-hmm. that seems like such a paradox to me, because mental health is something that literally everybody struggles with. And if on the off chance someone doesn't struggle with it, someone they know struggles with it, someone they love right. struggles with it,
right.
And will likely experience it at some point in their lifetime. So I was wondering, just to start out, if you could speak to that a little bit, what you think the stigma surrounding talking about mental health comes from.
I continue to see how much struggle there is around vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I think for many people, the stigma around mental health connects to that vulnerability.
That makes total sense. Yeah. I think vulnerability is something that is seen as a weakness so much of the time in our society. You write about this a little bit in your phenomenal book, The Age of Overwhelm, which is a life preserver for me. I've told you that, like I cling to that. You bring this up often, your own struggles staying afloat, working in the trauma field. Everyone carries their own trauma. You have your own trauma, and constantly being exposed to some incredibly traumatic events from other people is super intense. So yeah. I would also love to hear you talk about your own experiences with trauma and how you've gone about taking care of yourself amidst that.
I appreciate that. I mean, for me, the way I came in to do trauma work was really my own self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but so there's a concept, trauma mastery, which you're familiar with. Anyone who's joining us will be familiar with, even if we don't know that term specifically. But trauma mastery refers to this idea that one of the hardest things about primary trauma is the out of controlness of primary trauma. So what humans have done forever is we continue to recreate situations as similar to the traumatic incident as possible, because we tell ourselves this time we're gonna have a different outcome. So you can think about that in like three different realms. One is activities.
Yeah.
The second is relationships. And then the next is work, or how we spend our time.
Yeah.
So for example, in activities, you know, somebody might try to summit a mountain, for example. And mm-hmm. if an accident happens during the ascent, then trauma mastery would be you would return to that mountain a year later on the anniversary of the accident, and you're going to try to summit again, because this time you tell yourself nothing bad will happen.
Okay. Yeah.
Then there's relationships, which I think we all can have a lot of humility around. So this is that experience in our lives where we're like, why do I keep dating literally the person with the exact same characteristics, or what's up with my, you know, four annoying friends? Or so that experience of like, somehow this relationship, I'm going to sort it out. I'm going to work it out. And then it's how we spend our time and work that we're doing. For me, it wasn't a conscious decision to go into trauma work because of what I was trying to reconcile from my own life back in the day, but it definitely was a primary reason. And I went into trauma work during a time when we just, I mean, you know, it's 2020 now, we're still not talking very much about vicarious trauma and the cumulative toll. But back in the day, we were really not talking about it. You know, so that was 33 years ago.
One of the main things that I want to focus on in this interview series, and something that I addressed in my mission statement, is the intersectionality within mental health and the pressing need to decolonize the field. And we spoke a little bit about intergenerational trauma, race-related traumatic stress, and something that you write about in Age of Overwhelm is epigenetics. And I know that that's like a crazy huge field that is not necessarily something that can be easily summed up, but I would love to talk a little bit about that with you.
So with epigenetics, it's an emerging field. And what epigeneticists will tell you is that there's a way that environmental factors can affect our health and well-being, not just now, but can impact DNA for generations to come.
Sure.
You know, if you have a grandmother who had been lynched and no one in the family ever spoke about that, of course, we know the profound effects that can have for generations to come, even if it's something that hasn't gotten talked about over and over and over again, right? We know, I mean, you can know history, but it's different when you understand how it can be passed down, you know, in your DNA, in the fibers of your being, right? And how that then manifests present day.
Yeah. A conversation that I have with my therapist at least once a month, at the very least, is negotiating the difference between grief and trauma, and then anxiety and depression and other chemical imbalances. Because constantly I come in and I say, my depression is so bad. I'm literally losing my mind. Like, I've come in with a list of things that I've self-diagnosed myself with. Like, I'm bipolar. I have, you know, I have all these things.
Yeah.
My therapist every time goes, Lily, what if I told you that you're not going crazy? You don't need to go to a psych ward.
Right.
You are a normal grieving person. You are someone who has experienced trauma, and these things are so completely normal. And it would be strange if you weren't feeling these things. I'd love to hear you speak to that a little bit. I mean, like, just the fundamental differences, like one's a chemical imbalance and one is a situational issue.
Right.
And also how they should be handled differently.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so with what you're sharing, part of what is so challenging, again, people come to this with all different experiences of where you're born and where you're growing up and socialization.
Sure.
And that has so much to do with how you sift through all of that, because so much of how we do it as adults has to do with how we were raised and the messages we got back in the day about being able to, you know, as we say in early childhood education, have our big feelings.
Right? and my therapist says that to me again, like every time I see her. So it's not just early childhood.
Let's be comfortable having our big feelings. And, you know, we don't want to overgeneralize. Also, again, okay, so in the United States, there's a lot of rigid socialization about what it's appropriate for those who identify or being raised as male to feel and exhibit, and those who identify and being raised as female to exhibit. So that's one of the things that can really interrupt our ability to metabolize and really fluidly metabolize what we've been through and what we're currently being exposed to. The other piece with what you're sharing is that we're not known as a as a nation for having a lot of fluency in grieving and mourning and that culture, having a lot of strength in that culture where, you know, you're given what, 3 days, 3 to 6 days. And then it's like, turn your frown upside down. Okay. The lasagnas are gone. The banana bread's gone. there's so many props for like, are you okay? Are you okay? Like, you good? You good? You good? You good?
Get back to being productive. Yeah,
absolutely. And the United States has such a premium, as you're saying, on productivity and being in motion, right? And doing as opposed to being. And it's very, very hard to grieve and mourn and walk through the fire that we need to in the aftermath of a loss and simultaneously stay in motion.
Yeah, that is speaks so directly to my experience and being someone that's already predisposed to things like anxiety and depressive symptoms. It can really feel like I need to change my medication or something's severely wrong. My chemicals are completely imbalanced. But I think, like you were saying, there's a total underestimation of how long it does take to process traumatic losses and to process grief. The expectation that after a period of a few months, you're done, you know, and you've moved on. And it goes both ways. There were times in the month or 2 months after my dad passed away that, you know, I went to a concert, you know, or I had friends over, and it's like, you need to process that way. You need to be around people and you're smiling and you're laughing and you can't be in that dark place 24 hours a day. And people are kind of side eyeing you like, what's wrong with you? Like, you're not upset, you know? And then on the flip side, 8-9 months later, I'm in school, breaking down, not able to go to class, not able to focus. And again, people are side eyeing you like, what, it's been 9 months. What's wrong with you?
You know, I think our ability to extend grace to others, our ability to kind of have a lot of humility with each other and understand how we navigate grief and loss, it's very, very, it's a very personal experience. Yeah. And so you'll see people who, like you said, maybe they'll be highly social, or maybe their sense of humor will be really solid for the first 3 months. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then another wave comes. And it continues to come in waves, and it's not like it makes sense. You know, you're just standing in front of the ketchup section at the grocery store and a wave hits you and but it's that would be one thing if we were in a society that really allowed for that. And it's really, really tough in our society when it doesn't. And again, that combination of being in motion, you know, and doing as opposed to being.
A huge part of my own experience with trauma was experiencing 3 suicides with people that were incredibly important to me in the span of slightly over a year, one of which being my dad. Under the umbrella of mental health, as we're talking about grief being incredibly stigmatized, I think in my experience, suicide and suicidal ideation is one of the most heavily stigmatized elements of mental health.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'll be open, like, suicidal ideation is something that I've absolutely struggled with. And suicidal ideation just being like thinking about suicide or, you know, contemplating it. And in my experience, it's been more having lost so many people in a row to suicide, that feeling of like, what if that is the only way out? What if that's the only way to feel better? And just kind of a desire to like, I really don't want to feel this way anymore. Right. Like, what do I do? You know, and especially losing a parent to suicide, like that's, you are trying so hard to rationalize what could have led somebody to be in that place where like, this feels like the only option. Nobody knows how to react so much of the time. There's this weird stigma that weighs so heavily on it. Do you think that if there were more open and honest conversations about people feeling that way, would that be less of an issue? Would suicide rates be lower?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question and what you're sharing. And the idea that some people move through life and that they've never thought about it. even if it's not like an active plan, you know, but that feeling of like, I just want to like take a nap and not wake up for a while, right? That is, it's so surprising to me. And honestly, the stigma around it, sometimes I forget because I'll be sharing about it and then you'll see, you know, people kind of get their eyes open. You're just like, this isn't something you've grappled with. Yeah. I understand.
Or even if they have it, there's no language around talking about it or they feel like, oh, that's something I can never share with anybody.
Right. Yeah.
You know, in my experience, I lost one of my best friends in high school to suicide. And then almost exactly a year later, lost my dad to suicide. A few months later, lost dear friend Chester to suicide. Again, in those situations, so many people just have no idea what to say. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, people just didn't address me, which was a strange feeling, you know, because I think there's so much fear around like triggering other people, you know, or bringing things up that that you don't necessarily want to be brought up. So they think, oh, it's best not to say anything. Mm-hmm. And so much of the time that can feel just even more isolating. In my experience, how much I would have appreciated people even just asking, you know, like, is there anything I can, and your daughter, Michaela, is like shining star example, you know, like someone who is so cognizant and she remembers every anniversary, she reaches out, you know, and she also is just like, hey, I'm here if you want to talk about this, if you don't want to talk about this, if you want to go somewhere and be distracted, you know, or if you need to vent about it. Like, I think that just being open and asking people what they need.
I think what can be hard for folks to really understand in general, and certainly if they haven't survived a significant loss that they would define as a significant loss, is that the loss, there's never a time it's not with us.
Yeah.
Right? And I think, assuming well about folks, that I know for many people, what they might say is, well, I don't want to remind you of it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, like, can you think of a like a microsecond of any day when you do not have some level of awareness of your dad not being here?
Yeah. No, absolutely not. Yeah.
And so when folks opt for, I don't want to overstep, you know, and I don't want to possibly either be clumsy with it or, like you're saying, messy with it or remind you of it. Part of what happens then is it furthers our isolation, right? Because then we walk around with this experience of nobody's asking about him. Nobody says his name.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about him in a way that, like, he was real, you know, on any level. And of course, you're in an excruciating position of there's the public and there's the private piece of it,
sure.
Right?
Sure.
And so the way of you navigating this, where there might be this whole public realm to it, and yet privately, that you can spend huge amounts of time with folks where they don't talk about him and they don't ask you about him. And
it's a weird paradox. Yeah.
Very, very, very loving people who might not, for whatever reason, you know, reach out on Father's Day or reach out on his yard site. And understanding that for the person who's grieving, which it's a lifetime of grieving, we are really, really, really challenged right now in terms of how to support folks so that they know they have options other than taking their own lives. And that is throughout the ages of all ages that we're navigating this. And certainly, as you know, with adolescents and young adults. Mm-hmm. And isolation is one of the most damaging things there is, right? So we know that isolation is so damaging with trauma, and it's so damaging with issues of oppression. Yeah. And to your point, the more we collude with this isolation by not talking openly about this, I think it allows layer after layer after layer more that people then have to navigate when they're feeling desperate, when they're feeling at a loss. What we know in the aftermath of disasters and catastrophes and other extreme circumstances like we're in right now, one of the things that humans tend to do is we'll start to compare. We don't want to put suffering on a hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. It's not this competition of pain. Yeah. And so we don't want to compare everything to the most extreme, right? So that kind of minimizing and that comparison that can happen, I think, can be tough because it's on a continuum of folks' struggle right now. It's interesting for some folks who I think have had a history of struggling with any sort of mental health considerations, you know, there's a way that many of us can be thriving right now in a sense of like, oh, who knew my OCD was going to come in so handy? Because frankly, you know, I've consistently washed my hands. Also been very neurotic about wiping things down. So we laugh about this all the time in our family where, you know, there's those of us who struggle with OCD and those of us who don't.
Yeah.
And those of us who are struggling with OCD are like, crushing it. Look at that. Like, it's like varsity level. We got
yes.
it. This
yes.
is built for pandemic. I mean, the extreme like amount of like having to track everything. That's not great.
Yeah.
But like, when you have a fluency, you know, with feeling depressed, when you have a fluency with anxiety, when you have a fluency with OCD or any number of other things, then when these big waves come, there's a familiarity with it, right? Mm-hmm. And then if there's somebody who has never struggled with any OCD or hypervigilance, then this can be a really trippy time. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I'm seeing in all the ages I'm working with, which is young folks through really older folks, is where, you know, for 5 minutes you'll be feeling okay. And then the next 5 minutes you'll be feeling really, really depleted. And then the next 5 minutes you're actually kind of fine. And then the next 5 minutes you're super. And that kind of variability in mood, I think for, again, for folks who haven't had that experience of like, woo, if my moods are going to be like weather patterns today,
yes. Yeah.
Then that also can be really, really unnerving.
Anything that is giving you hope right now? I would love for that to be the last soundbite. Leave us with something that is inspiring you, that's giving you hope, helping you move through your days.
Honestly, being in relationship with you gives me so much hope that your ability, not solely to survive, though that as well, but watching how you move through things and watching how you show up at each juncture of your life is there's no words for it. It's deeply, deeply moving for me to continue to witness. So, remember how loved and adored you are, please.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you so much. And that means the absolute world coming from you, especially. And you have been such a huge resource for me, not just in this insane time, but I mean, I've known you since I was like, 15, 16,
and
your beautiful daughters, who I love with all my heart. You guys have all been such a huge resource to me. And someone who genuinely is like the most understanding and like compassionate person ever. And I mean, I can't, you know, people who don't know us, like, have no idea how many times I've been, I mean, I did this to you like last week where I'm like, Laura, something's happening and like, you need to address it.
Here's the latest sitch.
And for how much you have on your plate, like, I think you are such a beautiful example of being so compassionate and helping people through and helping people be aware of their own trauma while also taking care of yourself. Thank you so much for being here. I know we could talk for hours and hours and hours.
An absolute joy for me.
I can't wait for the world to hear the invaluable advice from you that I get on speed dial on a daily basis.
Woo!
Well, thank you, Laura.
Right.
I love
so
you.
So much love. Mwah! So much love. Talk to you soon.
If you like this episode, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a review.